We've all got to face the fact that it's going to be hard to sell anything for money this year. I think you're better off to have got a little stock around you than you would have been to get cash for the boxes. If I was in your place, I'd raise stuff I could use to feed my stock and something I could trade in at the store for groceries.
That's the line I've been thinking along. But I don't want to get more crops than I can get water to raise. Having the stock is fine, but it's left me less than $20 to buy seed with.
Fred always chewed tobacco, and when he was thinking hard, he had to spit a couple of times before he said anything. I bet myself he'd spit between the off-horse's heels first. But he fooled me. It was between the nigh horses. Then he said,
I'll tell you what, Charlie. 10 of that 20'll get you seed enough for 5 acres of sugar beets. You got beans enough left to sow 5 acres. And you can flail out oats enough to seed 20 acres from what's left of last year's crop. I've got a little stack of seed alfalfa that's 2 years old. I'll trade it to you for 4 days' work in haying time. With that machine you made, you could clean enough seed to put alfalfa in with your oats, and then you'd have a hay crop all laid down for several years.
Father said, Fred, you're the best neighbor a man ever had, but I am afraid you're an optimist. If I should get my full share of water, I'd only have enough for 10 acres. I've already got 10 acres of alfalfa. You are talking about my putting down another 30. I could not expect to do much more than lose my seed.
Fred chuckled a little, and then he said,
Man alive, you're the only one in the country that will be helped by this damned panic. You don't need money as much as you need food for the kids. I'll make you a bet you get all the damned water you need for 80 acres this year. Nobody up the ditch can hire hands this year any more than I can. The big fellows near the head of the ditch can't use all their share of water without help. They'll have to let part of it come on by, except when the ditch is the lowest. If you get your ground soaked deep during the spring and keep a dust mulch over it, you'll have moisture enough to make a crop. By another year, your alfalfa roots will be deep enough so they won't need so much summer irrigation.
That's the way we did it. We put Mother's garden and the beets and the beans way up at the southwest corner of the ranch, where the irrigation ditch came in, and put alfalfa in with the oats on the northwest field. Father got the bean field all plowed, harrowed, and marked off in squares before school let out for the summer. Afterwards, we dropped all the seed by hand, so we would be able to cultivate in all directions and keep a good dust mulch. I would drop 5 beans where the lines crossed. Then Father would hoe some dirt over them and tread on it. Chapter 21. I Break 9 Toes. Sweet clover grew in thick all over last year's pea field. Fred told Father it would make pretty good hay if it was cut while it was young and tender. He let us take his mowing machine to cut it, but Father would not let me go anywhere near the mower while the horses were hitched to it. I'd had my 9th birthday just before Christmas, and had been driving teams for a year. It seemed to me I was old enough to drive the mowing machine just a little while, and I knew it would be fun to set up on the little iron seat and watch the cutter bar flashing back and forth while the clover tumbled down. I guess I came pretty near begging Father to let me do it, but he said no. Then he told me it was too dangerous, but that he would let me drive the horse rake after the clover had dried into hay. I could hardly wait for it to get dry enough to rake. I knew just how to kick that foot pedal so the teeth would fly up and dump the hay in straight, even rows. I had watched Father do it all one evening the summer before. When the day for raking came, Father had to put a low seat on the horse rake because my legs weren't long enough to reach the foot pedal. He used the little iron one off of the mowing machine. I could set clear back in it and still reach the pedal. At first, Billy had been nervous on the mowing machine. The cutter bar went clackety-clackety-clack right behind his heels, and 2 or 3 times he acted as though he wanted to run away from it. But old Nig kept right on plodding along, and after 3 or 4 times around the field, Billy settled down. Father thought he might do the same thing when the horse rake dumped, so he drove the team for the first couple of rounds. Billy behaved as if he'd been pulling horse rakes all of his life. So Father boosted me up on the seat and passed me the lines. All he said was, "See if you can keep the windrows straight, clear across the field. And don't hurry the team at the corners." Right at the start, I had a little trouble in kicking the pedal at just the right second to keep the windrows straight. But I got the knack after the first two rounds. Everything went fine till the train came through, and I was planning how I'd be able to get a man's pay in haying time. Old Joe was the engineer on the combination train that went up to Morrison every forenoon and came back every evening. I had known him ever since Bill and Nig fell through the trestle, and we always waved at each other. I was so busy watching to see that I would kick the pedal just at the right moment, and maybe thinking about being old enough to make a man's pay, that I didn't even wave to Joe when the train went through. I guess he wanted me to see him wave at me, though. He blew three sharp blasts on the whistle when he was right even with me. You'd think the whistle might have scared Billy, but it was old Nig that started to run first. He jumped quicker than our tomcat did the time I hit him with a tomato. That made the Singletree bump Billy on the hocks, and he took off like a greyhound. The ground was bumpy where the bean rows had been, and the big high wheels of the horse rake bounced over them so that the iron seat jumped in every direction. The iron was smooth and slippery, and my bottom hopped around on it like a drop of cold water on a hot stove. I couldn't grab hold of anything with my hands because I had to haul on the lines for all I was worth. Billy could run so much faster than old Nig that we kept turning a little and a little till we were headed right into the passenger car at the end of the train. It just got out of our way before the horses galloped up over the track. I didn't know what I was doing, but I guess I grabbed hold with my toes when I couldn't hang on with my hands. When the wheels hit the first rail, it must have jarred the foot pedal down. The rake teeth flew up to dump the hay. That turned the angle iron bar I was holding on to with my toes and jammed them in between it with the stay rod. When we hit the other rail, the teeth flew down again and caught the rail. As the teeth went down, it let my toes loose, but the double tree broke right at the middle. Of course, that left the team free from the horse rake, and me, too. I had the lines wrapped good and tight around my hands, and I don't think I could have let go if I'd tried. I didn't try. I was too scared to think about my hands. With the double tree broken in two, there was nothing to hold the single trees up, and they kept bumping the horses on the heels. I was skidding along on my stomach with the single trees jumping around right in front of my nose and Billy kicking past my head every time his heels got bumped. They dragged me about halfway to the barn before they stopped. We had been stopped hardly long enough for me to know where I was before Father picked me up. I didn't know how much I was banged up until then, and I really didn't hurt much anywhere but in my toes. I must have been a little loco, because I don't remember unhooking Billy's trace chains from the single tree, but Father told Mother that's what I was doing when he got there. They carried me into the house and put me on their bed. I tried not to cry, but I did, just a little. It wasn't because I was hurt so much, either. It was just because I couldn't help it. And maybe, just a little bit, because I was glad I didn't get killed. About all there was left of my blouse was the collar band, and both legs got ripped off my overalls. Mother had hardly taken off what was left of them when old Joe and the train conductor, Mr. Duffy, came to the door. While Father went to let them in, Mother was feeling me all over. Her hands were shaky, and she cried more than I did. The first thing she said when they came in was, "Nine broken toes, and four of them nearly torn off. It will be a wonder if he ever walks again." Old Joe yanked his cap back onto his head and started right out again.
"Come on, Duffy," he hollered at him. "We'll highball for the fort and send Doc Stone out."
Mother wrapped a quilt around me and Father held me on his lap, with my feet soaking in a bucket of warm water, till Dr. Stone got there. While the doctor was thumping and poking me and listening to my insides with his little ear trumpet, he had me tell him what had happened. After we got done, he looked around at Mother and said,
"You don't never need to worry about this boy getting killed in an accident. He must have an in with the Almighty. If this leaky heart holds out, he ought to live to be 100.
I could have loved him for that, because the thing I was most afraid of was that Father and Mother would not let me handle horses any more. After he had wiggled my toes around some, he told Father to get a piece of smooth board and cut out pieces to fit the bottoms of my feet. When they were ready, he had Father saw slots between the places for my toes. It hurt like 60, and I yelled plenty when Dr. Stone was pulling my toes out so as to make the ends of the bones fit together, and while he was taping them down to the boards. He would put a little wad of cotton under one of them, then wind sticky tape around both it and the place Father had cut out in the board to match it. He let me rest for a little while after he had set all 5 toes on my left foot. Then he started to laugh when he was looking at the big toe on my right foot, the only one that did not get broken. I had a stone bruise on the bottom of it, and he said,
"Don't you ever holler about a stone bruise again. If this one hadn't been so sore that your nerves told your brain to keep it up out of the way, you'd have broken all of your toes."
I liked Dr. Stone, even if he did hurt me when he was setting my toes. Mother asked him how long I'd have to stay in bed. First he looked at me, then he looked at his watch and said,
"Oh, I'd say till about 7 o'clock tomorrow morning. I'll tape those wooden shoes around his ankles so they won't flop, and it won't hurt his toes any to clump around on them."
My toes and the places where I got skinned up hurt a lot more that night than they did right after I hurt them. Father slept out in the bunkhouse, and I stayed in bed with Mother, but I didn't sleep very much. Before Father went out to bed, he fixed me some brandy in a glass with sugar and water. I got kind of dizzy after I drank it, and I guess I slept some, but it was an awfully long night. The next morning, Father made me a pair of crutches out of 2 old broom handles, and I went out to the kitchen for breakfast. Mother had made the other youngsters stay outdoors after I got hurt and when the doctor was there, so I had not seen any of them. My toes didn't ache so much that morning, and I guess I was a little bit glad I did get in an accident because all the others kept looking at me as if I were somebody important. It's funny how word gets around when anybody gets hurt. The day after I broke my toes, most everyone in the neighborhood came to see me. Even Mrs. Corcoran came and told me I was a fool because I did not let go of the reins instead of getting dragged. Willie Aldevoat brought me a pair of doves that were just big enough to have feathers on them, and Fred Altland said he knew I was going to make a horseman the minute he laid eyes on me. The one I liked best to have come see me was King. He acted more sorry than anybody but Father and Mother, and he'd sit beside me for an hour at a time. Every little while, he'd lick my hand. Two Dog and Mr. Thompson came the second day. Two Dog had a little pouch full of dried leaves, and Mr. Thompson told Mother to boil them and put the broth on places where I was skinned. I don't think Mother would have done it if Mr. Thompson hadn't stayed all afternoon to watch. Anyway, she only put it on my hands and arms, and they were the first sores to heal. Mother let me eat supper out on the porch with Two Dog. He ate all his salt pork and Johnny cake, but he did not touch the beans, and I got Grace to bring out a bowl of sugar to go with his tea. Once in a while, he would reach over and lay his hand on the part of my leg that was not skinned, and I hoped he'd stay till late in the evening, eating sugar out of his hand. But Mr. Thompson harnessed the buckskins right after supper. I liked to have people come to see me and ask me about getting hurt. Really, my toes didn't ache very much after the first 2 days, but I thought it might be nice to act as though they were killing me, so Mother would give me lots of attention and more people would come to see how I was. I tried it for a while the next morning, but it wasn't any fun lying on the bed when Mother was busy in the kitchen and all the other youngsters were outdoors. I couldn't even fool King, and he would only come to the door and whine. By 9 o'clock, I took my crutches and went out to see how our new colt was getting along. I forgot all about the colt, though, because Father was just coming out of the barn and called me to come and see Brindle's new calf. In a few days, I got tired of my crutches and threw them away. Father glued pieces of leather on the bottoms of my wooden shoes so I would not wear out the binding tapes, and I could clump around pretty well. Of course, I had to walk kind of stiff-legged, the way you do on stilts. But it didn't bother a bit about riding Fanny. Father let me ride her to Fort Logan to see Dr. Stone, so I got a chance to let all of the kids in Logantown see that I had really broken 9 toes at one time. All the doctor did was to wiggle my feet around a little and put some fresh bandages on the skinned places. He looked real carefully at the places where Mother put on the broth from Two Dogs' leaves. Then he said, I do declare. You find out from that old engine what kind of leaves those were, will you? I said I would, but I always forgot it when I saw Two Dog. That spring, Mr. Welburn, a wealthy man from Denver, had bought the quarter section where I used to herd Mrs. Corcoran's cows. He had an artesian well sunk, and had trees set out along his driveways and where he was going to build his house. He used to pay me 50 cents a day to hoe and water them when we weren't busy haying. My broken toes cost me 2 whole weeks working for him, but Fred Altland said I would be worth just as much in haying as if my feet were all right. He said I wouldn't be able to break any more toes driving a horse rake now that I had boards on the bottoms of my feet, and he couldn't see any reason why I shouldn't do it. Fred must have talked to Father and Mother a lot, because they did not say no. We did a lot of haying that summer, because nobody but Mr. Welburn had any money to hire help, and the neighbors had to trade work back and forth. My 2 jobs were driving a hay rake and riding the stacker horse, and whatever place we worked. Father sharpened the mowing machine knives, fixed the broken machinery, and ran the stacker. When it was our turn, the neighbors all brought their machines and helped us. I always liked working at Altland's best. Fred used to butcher a pig for each of his 3 alfalfa cuttings, so there was plenty of fresh pork, and Mrs. Altland didn't seem to care how many chickens she fried or how much sugar it took to make pies and cookies. She and Bessie could cook almost as well as Mother, and they had lots more things to cook. While we were putting up Fred's first cutting of alfalfa, his cousin came out from Denver for a visit. He brought his wife and Lucy with them. Some of the other men said he was sponging on Fred because he loafed around and told stories a lot of the time. I think his wife and Lucy were sponging, too, because I never saw them help with the cooking or dishwashing, but I liked Lucy just the same. She was a year or two older than I, and while the horses were resting after dinner, we used to play up in the hayloft of the barn. She told me lots of things I hadn't thought about before. Her father had just been fired from a good office job in Denver, but Lucy didn't care. She said he'd been fired lots of times before, so it didn't make any difference. I remembered what Fred had told Father about needing food for us youngsters more than money, and I told Lucy about it. Then I said the Altlands had better things to eat than anybody else in the neighborhood, and I thought Fred would let them live right there if they did enough work. Lucy didn't like that at all. She asked me if I thought her father looked like a darn fool. Then, before I could tell her, she said that only dolts and darn fools lived on ranches because farmers didn't need any brains and there was too much hard work to do. When I got mad, she said that Fred and Father weren't fools because they owned their own ranches and hired men to do most of the work. I did not want to tell her that Father did not own our ranch, and I did not want her to think he was a darn fool, so I just kept still. Then she told me that smart men, like her father, never did have to work hard, because they knew that the world owed them a living, and there were easier ways to get it than doing hard work. I wanted her to tell me more about the easier ways, but the men had come out to get the horses, and Jerry Alder yelled, "Jigger up there in the haymow, Spikes! Your old man's coming!" All the men except Father and Fred were there, and when I started coming down the ladder, Jerry called up to me, "I'll bet you learned a hell of a lot of new things up there. Did you do any good?" I told him I didn't know if I did any good, but I sure learned a lot of new things. Then, before I could tell him anything about the world owing everybody an easy living, they all started howling and laughing. Lucy's father laughed louder than anybody else. While we were milking that night, I told Father what Lucy said about her father and asked him why he didn't try to do the same thing. I only saw Father mad 2 or 3 times, but that was one of them. He jumped up off of his milking stool and came around behind Brindle. His face was gray-white. Even his lips were white. And his voice was shaky when he said, "Don't you ever talk to that girl again." He just stood there for a minute, as if he didn't know what he was going to say, and then he put the stool right down in front of me and sat on it. He reached out and took hold of my knee hard. His voice didn't shake then, but he talked low.
"Son, I had hoped you would not run into anything like this till you were older. But maybe it's just as well. There are only 2 kinds of men in this world, honest men and dishonest men. There are black men and white men, yellow men and red men. But nothing counts except whether they are honest men or dishonest men. Some men work almost entirely with their brains, some almost entirely with their hands. Now most of us have to use both. We all fall into one of those 2 classes, honest or dishonest. Any man who says the world owes him a living is dishonest. The same God that made you and me made this earth. And he planned it so that it would yield every single thing that the people on it need. But he was careful to plan it so that it would only yield up its wealth in exchange for the labor of a man. Any man who tries to share in that wealth without contributing the work of his brain or his hands is dishonest. Son, this is a long sermon for a boy of your age, but I want so much for you to be an honest man that I had to explain it to you."
I wish I knew how Father was able to say things so as to make you remember every word of it. If I could remember everything, the way I remember the things Father told me, maybe I could be as smart a man as he was. Chapter 22. Bad times were not so bad. We had traded what was left of our good beans for groceries at Mr. Green's store in Logantown, but there were a couple of sacks of our peas and all of our landlord's peas and beans left in the bunkhouse. The landlord wrote us in September and wanted Father to bring his share of the good beans in to Denver and as many of his peas as we could haul. After the letter came, Mother got down her Wedgwood sugar bowl and poured the money out on the kitchen table. There was only $24.25 in it. Most of it was money I got working for Mr. Welburn. Of course, we had receipts for 15.5 tons of hay in there, too. That was how we got paid for work we did for other people in haying time. When the money was counted, Mother told Grace to take all of the youngsters but me out to play and to ask Father to come in. The 3 of us sat around the table where the money and Mother's memo pad were laid out. She said I had earned so much of the money that I should help decide how much of it we could afford to spend and what we would buy with it. The bottoms of my feet were so tender from having worn my boards all summer that I could not go barefoot, and my Christmas shoes were all worn out. Mother said I would have to have new ones before school started, and she thought we'd better pay $2 and get a good pair because my Christmas shoes didn't wear very well. Then she said she could can tomatoes and green peas and beans from the garden if we could afford to buy some canning jars and rubber stoppers. After that, we started going over the list of unbleached muslin, calico, quilting cotton, and other things she had written down on her pad. Really, the Father and I didn't do much of the planning. Mother would guess how much different things would cost and put down the amount. Then she would add it up and say,
"Oh, my, that's a lot more than we can afford to spend, Charlie. Do you think there will be a cash market for sugar beets or beans or hay this fall?"
Father only said,
"I hope so, but the panic seems to be as tight as it was in the spring. Maybe things will open up a little before cold weather."
Mother would cross off some of the things on the list and change the amounts on others. Then she would sum up and say,
"Oh, my,"
again. At last it got down to where it was just my shoes, some cloth for winter coats and dresses, and the canning jars, if Father could trade our 2 sacks of dried peas for them. And then we'd have $10 left in the sugar bowl for emergencies. We loaded the big wagon that night, and Father let me go to Denver with him the next morning. We started way before daylight. Mother made me wear Grace's new shoes and the stockings she had knit with yarn from an old shawl. The last thing Father did before we left was to tie the feet of Brendel's calf together and lay him up on top of the load. Grace's shoes hurt my toes, and the stockings made my legs prickle, so Father let me take them off till we were almost into the Capitol building. First, we went right to the Golden Eagle and got my new shoes. Then we drove by Cousin Phil's office, and Father sent me up to get him. The office didn't look a bit the way it used to. There was nothing left in it but 2 chairs and a desk. The stenographer was gone, desk, typewriter, and all. And Cousin Phil looked terrible. He told me to stay there and look at the newspaper on his desk while he went down and talked to Father. He was gone a long time, and when he came back he said I was to stay with him while Father went to do his trading. There wasn't a thing for me to do in that office, and nobody to talk to. Cousin Phil just kept reading the newspaper and looking at his watch every once in a while. About noontime he went out and brought me back a couple of donuts, but he didn't bring himself any, and he wasn't gone long enough to have eaten lunch. He did talk a little after he came back. He told me he had a big deal all ready to go through, but the panic had knocked the bottom out of everything. Then he asked me how I'd like to have Prince to drive instead of old Fanny, and said he thought a while on the ranch would be good for the little bronc. All afternoon I watched from the window for Father to come back, but it was nearly supper time before he got there. Prince was tied to the tailgate of the wagon, but Cousin Phil did not even come down to the window to look at him. He just told me to run along so as not to keep Father waiting, and said he'd be out to see us before too long. As soon as I climbed up on the wagon, I could see that Father had several good-sized bundles piled up in the front end, and 6 boxes with pictures of canning jars on them. When I asked him how he got so many things with only $14.25, he kind of chuckled a little bit and pulled his leather pouch out of his pocket. There was still some money in it, and from the sound of the jingling, I knew some of the pieces were as big as $0.50. And then he told me that Mother had overlooked the fact that everything was a lot cheaper since money had gotten so scarce, but he wouldn't tell me what was in the packages. He said I'd have to wait till we could all look at them together. After that, I asked him what was the matter with Cousin Phil and why he did not have the stenographer and her things in his office anymore. He didn't answer me for a few minutes. Then he told me we had not stopped to realize how well off we were to have enough to eat every day, and to have a good home and clothes enough to keep us warm, when there were people who were actually starving. I remembered about eating both of the donuts that Cousin Phil brought back at noon, and asked Father if he thought maybe that he was starving. He said no, Cousin Phil would never starve, but he thought the panic had clipped his wings a little bit. Father and I were both as hungry as we could be, and just talking about having plenty to eat made us hungrier. When we got out by the lumber barn, we bought a custard pie and a pail of milk in the same little store where we had got them when we were first moving out to the ranch. While Billy and Nig were eating their oats, Father and I ate our pie and talked about all of the new things we had been able to get since we had been sitting there eating a custard pie less than 2 years before. It seemed to us then that we were going to be rich people before very long, and the next morning it seemed to everybody at home that we already were. School did not start that fall till we had everything from our garden that we had not peddled put away in the cellar. We got some more canning jars and sugar from Mr. Green in trade for a pig and some vegetables. Mother filled every one of the jars with green corn, tomatoes, peas, and green beans. Father built bins on the cellar floor, and we loaded them with carrots, table beets, and turnips. We had put horse manure under the potatoes when we planted them, and they all went to tops, as my cowboy friend High had said they would. It was Mother who got the idea about selling vegetables at the Ford. She said that officers in the army got paid cash whether there was a panic on or not, and she'd bet their wives would buy fresh vegetables. I think Father would rather have taken a beating than do it. But we went from one back door to another all through the officers' quarters in Fort Logan till we'd sold all the garden stuff we did not need for ourselves. It brought in nearly $21. Denver must not have been a good place to be during the panic, because Prince looked nearly as bad as Cousin Phil. He was skinny, and didn't have anything like the pepper he used to have when I first saw him. Father started giving him 2 quarts of oats every morning and night, and by school time he'd run like a rabbit again. Father let us drive him once in a while till he found out what was going on at school, but after that we had to take Fanny. He might not have found out about it at all if I had not got my face skinned. Willie Aldevoat rode a horse to school that fall instead of the old spotted donkey. It wasn't much of a horse, but he had a saddle for it, and it was a good saddle. It was wide in the pommel, with a short seat and double cinches. Willie said it was a breaking saddle. We put it on all of the horses at school and tried to make them buck, but Prince was the only one that would. At first, he didn't buck very much harder than Willie's donkey used to, but the more we tried to ride him and the more oats he got, the harder he bucked. After a while, he didn't crow-hop, but would bounce from one side to the other and turn almost end for end while he was in the air, and he'd get his nose right down between his front hooves. It got so only Willie and I could stay on him at all, and we got tumbled off plenty of times. I couldn't reach the stirrups, and I did not dare put my feet into the stirrup straps with my shoes on, for fear one of them would stick and drag me when I got thrown, so I always had to ride barefoot. Even at that, my foot stuck one noontime when I went off sideways and Prince dragged me a few feet. Miss Wheeler fixed me up all right with a little cork plaster, but of course Grace had to tell Mother what had happened. Maybe it was just as well, though, because after that Prince bucked so crazy there was hardly a man in the neighborhood who could ride him. Right after Thanksgiving, Hal came running up the wagon road to meet us when we were coming home from school. He was just past 4 years old then and nearly as wide as he was tall. We could hear him jabbering as he came, and he was so excited he could hardly wait for Fanny to stop before he started trying to climb up over the wheel of the buckboard. In between gasps, he was hollering.
We got a new horse. She's got a colt, and she's brute, and her name is Bread.
I guess we all got about as excited as Hal was, and I turned in at the gate so fast that I nearly slewed him off of the seat. Father and Mother were out at the corral with the new mare and colt. The mare was a nice-looking bay, a little bigger than Fanny, and smooth as butter. The colt looked to be a yearling, and was a bright sorrel. Father let me walk right up to the mare and pat her on the neck. I wanted to be gentle with her and have her like me, so I went close to her, and I said, "Easy, Bread, easy, Bread." Mother heard me and said,
"What is that you're saying?"
So I told her Hal said that the mare's name was Bread. Mother's face looked kind of funny for a minute, and she pulled her lip down as if she were trying not to laugh. Then she said,
"No, no, Hal must have been mistaken when he heard Father talking to Mr. Cash about her. No, she doesn't have a name yet, but she's going to have another little colt pretty soon. Isn't she beautiful? She's a perfect little lady."
Mother did not know it then, but she'd named our new mare. Nobody ever called her anything but Lady after that. Grace named the colt Babe. Afterwards, Father told me that we had bought Lady and Babe with receipts for the 8 tons of hay we had earned during haying time. He said I had a part interest in her, but I could never ride her as hard as I did Fanny, because she was a brood mare. Christmas that year was even better than the year before. Father bought a whole box of yellow bellflower apples, and we had our biggest young tom turkey and cranberry sauce and even celery. We all got new shoes and stockings, and Mother had made new winter coats for Philip and me without our knowing about them. I got a set of dominoes and a 2-line bit for a riding bridle. Muriel's cat thought she ought to give some presents, too, and she must have counted noses, because she had a litter of 5 kittens on Christmas Eve. We had taken 3 good cuttings of alfalfa off of the field we sowed our first year on the ranch, and the stand on the new field was rank and good. Our beans had ripened before the frosts came. We had enough water to fill the oats, and there were tons and tons of sugar beets. The only trouble was that we could sell hardly anything. Father had Mr. Lewis bring his machine and thresh our oats and beans. It took 2 days to thresh them, and I stayed home from school to carry water and milk and donuts around to the men. When the job was done, Father paid Mr. Lewis in oats and beans, but all the other men owed us hay, so we just changed each man's receipt to show he owed us a little less hay. It was fun to watch the stream of the clean, white beans come pouring out of the threshing machine, and then think about all of the work we had the winter before to flail, winnow, and sort them. Our 19 pigs did far the best of all those in the neighborhood, because they lived on sugar beets from the time we started thinning out the rows in the spring. And the sugar beets made the meat so much sweeter that we could trade our pork in at Mr. Green's store when other people could not. Grace and Philip could not get jobs away from home like Father and me, but they were the ones who really got us the groceries that winter, because they thinned the beets and fattened the pigs. And it was getting the pigs fat that helped us more than anything else. Everybody had wanted some of our beets to fatten their hogs, and nobody had any money, so Father traded beets for all of the tools and machines we needed to make us good ranchers who wouldn't have to borrow. Of course, none of the things he got were new, but Father did not need new things. He could fix up the old ones so they would work just as well. Our landlord came out just before Christmas, and Father gave him part of our share of the oats and beans for his share of the beets. Father made a deal with him for us to work out the land taxes by helping build roads, too. That way, we did not have to give up so many beans. Road work started right after hay baling, and I liked it best of all of the work that we did. The county allowed $1.50 a day for a man and $1 a day for a wagon and team of horses. Lady had foaled her colt, a pretty sorrel filly that we named Bonnie, so she was able to work. And with the wagon and harness Father got in trade for beets, we had 2 teams to put on road work. Father drove Lady and Fanny, and I drove Billy and Nig, and they allowed $1.50 a day for me, just like the other men. All of the land was adobe. In the summer, the roads baked hard as a brick. But when they were wet, the mud clung to the wagon wheels till they were 1 foot thick. The only way to fix that kind of road was to spread gravel over the adobe during the winter and let it work down with the spring rains. The men who had big teams worked on the grader that cut the side ditches and rounded dirt up to form the roadbeds, but those with lighter teams hauled gravel. Father and I hauled gravel. There was a crew of men down on the gravel bar in Bear Creek to do the loading, and another crew did the unloading, so all Father and I had to do was drive the teams. The bar was on the far side of the creek from the road we were building, and we had to come through the ford with loaded wagons. Several of the men got stuck coming through the ford, and I was always afraid it would happen to me. One day, Father and I got our wagons loaded at the same time, and he was right behind me when I started through the ford. If there was ever a time I did not want to get stuck, it was when Father was right there to see me. Before Billy and Nig had their feet in the water, I started clucking and popped them with the end of the lines. When the line end hit his rump, Billy jumped ahead and nearly threw Nig off balance. I yelled, "Get up, Nig!" and swung the end of the line at him. He was wearing an open bridle, and he must have seen it coming, because he lunged into his collar so hard he jerked Billy back against the wagon. Then I guess I lost my head and started snapping the line end out the way a mad snake does its tongue. The wagon was right in the middle of the ford, where the sand was the deepest, when Father called, "Stop!" I didn't have to say whoa to the team. There was something in Father's voice that they understood as well as I did. He jumped off his wagon, waded right into the creek, and stood beside my front wheel. "If I ever see you abuse a horse again, I'll put you at a hard job and give you the same treatment. Now, pass me those lines." What Father said hurt me so bad my throat felt as if I were trying to swallow a baseball, but it did not scare me. It was his wading into the icy cold water that had scared me. Whenever he got cold and wet at the same time, he always took a bad cold and would cough sometimes till there was blood on his handkerchief. I passed him the lines, but I was sure we were stuck so hard it would take another team to get us out. Father drew the reins tight so both horses were even. Then he clucked once, and the team set their shoulders and leaned into the collars. It was beautiful to watch. At first, the wagon did not budge. But it looked as though Father were pushing on those lines instead of pulling them, and it almost seemed that I could see his will passing through those lines to the horses. The muscles bunched out on their thighs until they quivered, and the wagon inched forward. With their feet planted deep in the sand, they kept it moving, moving, until they were stretched out like show horses in a stance. Then their two nigh hooves moved forward as if they had been both lifted by the same brain. Step by slow step, the wagon moved through the deep sand and up the bank. As soon as we were on level ground, Father passed me the lines and waded back to his own team without a word. I always loved him more after he had scolded me than I did at any other time. While Billy and Nig rested and got their wind, I watched Father come through the ford with Lady and Fanny. He had as heavy a load as I did, and my team was once and a half as big and as strong as his. I could not see how he would ever get through the deep sand. At the brink of the far bank, he stopped them for just a minute. Then he drew up the lines and said, "Hup!" It was quick and sharp. The light mares went down the bank with a rush, over the bar, through the ford, and up the bank. I watched their feet, and they were in perfect time every step of the way. I got tears in my eyes, and when Father stopped his team to rest, I wanted to go back and tell him I was sorry and would never abuse a horse again, but he waved for me to drive on. I didn't feel a bit good, and as I came up to the grader, Fred Altland asked me what was the matter. I told him I had got stuck in the creek and Father had to wade in to get me out. Fred knew about Father's cough as well as I did, and he was boss of the road gang, so when Father drove up, Fred sent him right home to get on some dry clothes. When he had started, Fred yelled after him,
"And tell Mame to give you a big slug of brandy."
I don't know whether she did or not, but Father did not get a cold that time. That was the best winter we ever had. New Year's Eve, Mother got out her little red book and figured up all of the money we had taken in during 1908. It was only $54.85, but there was never a time when we were hungry or when we did not have railroad ties enough to keep our fire going. Our cellar was full of bins and jars of vegetables and barrels of salt pork. Father had built a little smokehouse where we cured the hams and bacon and pork shoulders with corn cobs, so the bunkhouse rafters were hung with all of the smoked meat we could eat until summertime. And the floor was piled high with sacks of oats and beans. We even had half a bushel of popcorn. It was a cold winter with only a little snow, and we did not have much work to do except to take care of the stock and saw ties for the fire. But the evenings were best of all. Grace and Muriel and I would do our lessons as soon as we got home from school, so as to have all evening to play. We learned two plays that winter, but Grace and I usually had an argument over which one we'd do. She liked The Merchant of Venice best, because she was Portia. But I liked Julius Caesar best, because I was Julius and got killed at the Capitol. Mother had to take most of the long parts, like Cassius, but Father was Mark Antony, and even Hal learned lines for Metellus. If we weren't doing a play, Mother had us make cross-stitch chair covers while she read to us and Father popped corn or mended a harness. Some evenings, Carl Henry would bring Miss Wheeler over to play whist with Father and Mother. Three or four times, his friend, Dr. Brown, came with them. Those nights, Mother let Grace and me sit up till 9 o'clock, and Dr. Brown would play casino with us. He liked it better than whist, and we liked him a lot. Chapter 23, Tornado and Cloudburst. The weather was what Fred Altland called spotty during the winter and spring of 1908-1909. Where we lived, and through the mountains right west of us, up toward Evergreen and the Bear Creek watershed, there was only a little snow all winter, but just south of there, along the headwaters of the Platte River, the snowfall was quite heavy. That was why Bear Creek ran low all summer, while the Platte and Turkey Creek ran full. In March, we had a tornado. It came on a warm Sunday afternoon when Father and I were down by the creek. It looked like a big black balloon with its tail tied to the top of Mount Morrison. Father saw it first and called, "Tornado!" Then he started running back toward the house. I ran after him as fast as I could go, but his legs were so much longer than mine that he beat me by 5 rods. That was the first time I noticed how much better he had gotten during the winter. He didn't even cough with all of that running. As we went past the house, he called, "Tornado!" to Mother and kept right on toward the barn. We turned all of the stock loose and drove it out through the gate, past our barbed wire fence. Then we propped poles against the house, tipped over the hay rack and wagons, and ran for the cellar. The first hard blast of wind hit us just as we got to the door, but in 5 minutes, it was all over. When we came out, Father showed me where the twister had veered off to the north and cut a regular road up over Larson's Hill, 2 miles straight across Bear Creek Valley from our place. The second Saturday after that, Mother sent me to take a dress pattern over to Mrs. Larson. I rode Fanny and went around by the West Denver Road and through the ford. I should have come right home, but we did not have much work to do that day, so I went to look along the tornado path. Father had told me some of the curious things twisters can do, like driving a wheat straw through a fence post without breaking it. While I was poking around, I heard a sound like thunder from way off toward the mountains. I looked up, and there was another big black cloud half hidden behind Mount Morrison. As I watched it, it lifted a little, seemed to draw itself into a tighter ball, and grew a lot blacker. I was sure it must have a tail on it, and that I could have seen it if the mountain had not been in the way. At first, I thought about going back to Larson's storm cellar, but I was afraid nobody at home had seen the storm coming and that it might strike them before they could turn the stock loose and get to the cellar. I flung myself flat on Fanny's neck, slapped her with the line ends, and raced straight for the hillside going down toward the creek. There was no time for going around by the ford, and I knew right where to hit the old cattle bridge in Cooley Lundy's pasture below our house. The hillside was rough pasture land, covered with sagebrush, Spanish dagger, and cactus, and the rain had washed a little gully all through it. I knew better than to race Fanny down over it, but when I came in sight of the creek, I noticed that it had risen nearly to the top of the banks. Then I realized there was a cloudburst coming instead of a tornado, and that the water might be over the bridge before we could get there. Fanny never did like to run downhill, but that day she seemed to know we were racing against the storm, and streaked down across the pasture, dodging sagebrush, leaping gullies, and sliding through shale rock. I had to clamp my knees tight and lie close to her neck to keep from being thrown. When we hit the edge of the valley floor, Fanny took Lundy's irrigation ditch in a clean, low jump and tore out across the alfalfa field toward the cattle bridge. I don't think I reined her at all. She knew what I wanted to do as well as I did. Thunder seemed to be crashing all around us. I glanced up toward the mountains, but I could not see them. The black cloud was lying right against the ground, and between claps of thunder I could hear a roaring up the valley. The creek was about a half a mile from our house, and at that point it clung tight against the foot of a steep, brush-covered hill. A narrow trail led down to the old cattle bridge. As we raced toward it, I could see that the water was clear up to the bridge girders, and that part of the bank had washed away, so there was a gap of 2 or 3 feet between us and the planking. I was afraid Fanny might not see it, and brought the line end down sharp against her rump to lift her over. While my arm was still in the air, the wind and the rain hit us like the cracker of a bullwhip. Fanny jumped and sailed across the open strip of mad, swirling water. It was a long, high leap that carried us nearly to the middle of the span. Her nigh forehoof thudded down against a half-rotten plank and crashed through. I didn't see her fall. I only saw her head go down, and then I was thrown toward the bank like a kitten flung by a dog. I missed the bridge, and my arm ripped against the end of the planking as I fell headfirst into the muddy, rushing water. I could not swim. But I don't think it would have made a bit of difference. When my head came up, I was 5 or 6 feet from the bank. I just caught a glimpse of it as I tried to suck in a mouthful of air, but I got mostly water, and the current rolled me over and took me under again. That time I scraped against a bush, grabbed hold, and hung on. I was lucky, because its roots were in the side of the bank, and it swung me around like a picket rope. When my head came up again, I was under a big sage bush that leaned out over the water. I was choking so bad it made my arms weak, and I could hardly pull myself up out of the creek. I should have thought about Fanny the first thing, but the choking made me sick at my stomach, and for a minute or two I couldn't think at all. Then she squealed. I never knew a sound could hurt like Fanny's squeal. I felt something had hold of me and was tearing me in two. When I hauled myself up through the sagebrush, I could see her muzzle and part of one twisted foreleg sticking above the water that was flowing over the bridge. I guess I lost my head when I saw it. The current had washed me about 60 feet down the creek, so I scrambled along the bank to the bridge trail and ran toward Fanny. I didn't even stop to think that the water might have carried the planks away, but splashed out onto the bridge. Her leg was broken over sideways just below the knee, and her hoof was caught in the hole that it had made. She was straining to hold her head above the water, and her eyes looked up at me as if she were begging me to help her. I don't think I ever planned what I did. I guess I just did it because I loved her. I jumped onto her head and clamped my legs around it. Her muzzle slipped off the end of the planks when I landed, and she struggled once or twice. Then my head went under too. I only knew the water was turning me over and over. A couple of times my mouth came to the top and I tried to gasp in some air. Then, Father's face was right above mine, and his hands were pumping up and down on my back. I was lying with my head downhill, and my face was turned to the side so I could see Father's. It was as gray as ash. I couldn't seem to make my body wake up when my head did, and Father's voice sounded a long way off. He kept asking me if I was all right. I was, except that my lungs hurt, but I couldn't say so till after he had taken me up. He was soaking wet and muddy from the creek, but he opened his shirt and held my chest close against him. As he climbed the trail, I looked back toward where the bridge had been. The water had risen another foot or two, and Fanny's neck and withers showed above it. The rawhide thong Two Dog had braided into her mane floated up and down on the current, as though it were waving goodbye to me. I think that was what made me cry. I tried to tell Father what had happened, but he had seen the last of it himself. From our house he had seen me start running down across Larson's Hill as the storm was gathering, and had run for the creek himself to warn me back before it rose. Mother made me stay in bed 2 or 3 days till she was sure my lungs were all right, and that my cuts weren't going to get infected. I had a couple of cracked ribs and a little fever, and Father brought Dr. Stone out, but he just gave me some pills and strapped me up. Then he told Mother again that I'd never get killed in an accident. By the time I got up, Father had buried Fanny. I rode Lady down there so I could see her grave. But I was glad I didn't see Fanny. Chapter 24. I Become a Cowpoke. The flood washed out the dam at the head of our irrigation ditch and tore away most of the gates and locks. Father and all of the other ranchers along the ditch had to work for a couple of weeks to fix up the damage. And then there came pretty near being another battle, and everybody had to go to court to find out how much of the cost they had to pay. We drove Prince to school for a couple of weeks at the beginning of April. That was after my ribs got well enough so I could go back to school, and Father was using Lady for plowing. After that we had to walk, because Cousin Phil came out and got Prince. The gold panic ended about that time. Fred Altland started hauling hay again, and Mother sold 5 pounds of butter for cash. Mr. Welburn sent a man out from Denver to take care of his trees, and I hadn't been able to make a penny all spring. And I did not know what I was going to do after school let out May 1st. I almost wished I were going to herd Mrs. Corcoran's cows again. It would be June before Fred's hay was ready to cut, and there would not be much to do at home except to weed Mother's garden. And besides, I was lost without Fanny. I was talking about it one noon at school, and somebody must have told Mr. Cooper. Anyway, he came over to our house that evening and said he had heard I was hunting work for the summer. Father told him I was always hunting work anywhere except in Mother's garden, but he thought I'd find enough mischief to get into right at home. Mr. Cooper lived 5 miles from our place, over west of Littleton and near to the mountains. They got their irrigation water from Platte Canyon and didn't have any ditch fights, so they always had good crops. He had one of the biggest ranches anywhere around and always hired a dozen or so men in the summer. Before he went home, he told us he would pay me $20 a month and give me steady work from May 1st till the end of September. Then he said he did not have to have an answer for a couple of days and that he'd drop back and see us again. I wanted to go to work for Mr. Cooper worse than I'd ever wanted anything. I pestered Father and Mother a lot about it. At first, Father said I could not go because Fred Altman had given me work for the past 2 years and depended on me to ride his stacker horse. Well, Grace could ride a stacker horse just as well as I could, and she did not think it was fair that I got all of the money-making jobs while she had to stay home and help Mother. I went to see Fred on my way home from school the next night and talked to him about it. He said he'd give me $20 a month himself, if the last year hadn't been so tough, but if I wanted to take Mr. Cooper's job, Grace could ride old Jeff. Maybe that had something to do with Father and Mother letting me go. First, Mother made Mr. Cooper promise to let me come home every Saturday night, and Father made him say I could sleep in the house instead of out in the bunkhouse with the men. Mr. Cooper came for me the Sunday night after school closed. Before we got to his place, I knew I was going to like working for him, as well as I liked working for Fred Altland, but I didn't begin to realize how much I was going to like it. The first one I saw when we drove into his place was my old cowboy friend, High. He knew me right away. He was standing by the corral fence with some other cowboys when we drove in and yelled, "Hi there, little britches! How many toes you broke so far this spring?" Mr. Cooper told me High was his cattle foreman and was a great booster of mine. Then he said for me not to let High spoil me, but I did not know what he meant. After Mr. Cooper had taken me to the house and his wife had shown me where my room was, I went back out to the corral. There were 7 or 8 other cowboys there with High, and they were talking about bringing cattle down from the mountains for sorting and branding. When High saw I had come back, he picked me up and set me on the top rail of the corral. Then he wanted me to tell the other fellows about going up to Two Dogs and getting caught in the cloudburst. I did not want to talk about killing Fanny in the flood, and I guess High saw I was getting a little choked up, so he asked me where I had put my saddle and blanket. Of course, I never had a saddle or blanket, but I didn't like to say so and said I liked to ride bareback better. All of the fellows but High laughed when I said that, and one of them hollered, "My God, High, that'll learn you not to waste a week's time saddle-making." High looked kind of funny for about a minute, and I guess I looked funnier. Then he started to laugh, too. "Well, damn you little britches, you are going to ride that little old saddle I made, or I'll hang it around your skinny neck." He reached up and hauled me off of the rail and carried me to the bunkhouse under his arm, the way you'd carry a little pig. Before Father had said I had to sleep in the house, High had fixed my bunk right next to his. He had the quilt spread over my saddle, bridle, and blanket. They were the prettiest ones I ever saw, and I had to bite my tongue to keep from squealing. It was a breaking saddle like Willie Aldevolt's, only a lot better. The pommel was wide and thick, and it flared out a little before it drew in to the horn, so a fellow could lock his legs in under it. The horn was only high enough to get a rope around and had a nice rake forward. The knob must have been covered half an inch thick with leather. There were wide skirts to the stirrup straps, double horsehair cinches, and a rawhide latigo thongs front and back. The blanket was a Navajo, brown, with bright green zigzag stripes, and the bridle was silver-mounted with a curb rowel bit. I could not believe that Hai was giving them to me, that they were really my own. It was pitch dark before Hai got through showing me the saddle and making me understand that it was mine to keep. Then Mr. Cooper came out to the bunkhouse and told me it was time for me to come in and turn in for the night. He said the boys would do me enough damage when we were out working stock, and he was going to see that I got my sleep when I was at the home place. We ate breakfast in the cook shack, and the cook was a Mexican who could hardly speak a dozen words of English, but he could make good biscuits and flapjacks, and he put lots of onions and pepper in his fried potatoes. I ate so much that it nearly came out of my ears. At breakfast, Mr. Cooper told me that when we were working with the cattle, Juan, the Mexican cook, would be my boss most of the time because I'd be the water boy, but that he would do the bossing when we were at the home place. Then he said I could loaf around that day and get acquainted while the men were getting ready for the branding. When we were through eating, we all started out to the corrals. On the way, Hai said the first thing I ought to do was to pick my horse. I don't think Mr. Cooper liked to have him say it because he said,
"Didn't you hear me tell Little Britches I'd do the bossing around the home place? I think his pa and ma had sooner he'd ride Topsy or Eva."